So here we are, and the system is broke. American dream has gone up in smoke. So stop sitting there all brokenhearted. Let's get this motherfucking party started. Lady Liberty is ringing a bell, and we're driving us straight into hell. But don't worry, we got what you need. Crank up the volume till your eardrums bleed. Go make America, America again.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the A Better Way 2A podcast. We're your hosts, Andrew and Jordan, and we're here this week with Jonathan Wild. He's an author, he's a garage gun and rocket launcher manufacturer, a 3D printing guru, I would say, an expert at handling the ATF, and an immigrant from our favorite neighbor across the ocean, the UK.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I very much appreciate it.
We never make bad jokes about the UK. We're always super polite about them.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, man.
Appreciate it.
It's so hard for me to keep a straight face when Andrew's doing his intros, because I feel like I intentionally make mine so high energy to like set up the rest of the episode, and Andrew's got this ASMR.
I come in cool.
No, you're good, man. I like it. It's a nice like yin and yang, and I think it's good to have.
You need a bit of both.
Absolutely. I feel like we need some smooth jazz to play right now while we're doing this episode, though.
All right. Well, did I miss anything? Tell us something about yourself that I didn't say that we don't know.
Yeah. You know, I came here from the UK back in 07. My parents brought me over when I was fairly young. And, you know, just going gun related, I mean, the first time I fired a gun was when I was like 11 or 12 years old. And I'd never knew you could even own a gun, because growing up in England, it's very much, you know, gun ownership in England is actually larger than what people give it credit for. But if you're not in that community in the UK, then you don't know anything about it.
Well, there's kind of a moral stigma, isn't there?
Very much. Like, I always wanted like BB guns and like an air rifle and stuff. And it was just kind of
my parents. What are you, a psycho, Jonathan?
Exactly. You get that mentality of like, oh, no, that's not a good thing to have. And then I think I went to, because a lot of it is from rural folk in the English countryside, they'll have air rifles. So I went to a friend's house, and that was the first time I fired like an air rifle. I didn't hit anything.
Kind of lit up your Canadian roots.
Yeah.
So it's just like unlocked some like DNA genetically stored like gun pathology.
Almost. Yeah. American must have AR-15.
And build rocket launchers.
Yeah.
I went off the deep end on that one.
Yeah. It happens that way sometimes.
But yeah, basically, I just remember always liking weapons and guns, like through video games growing up, or just like BB guns. And like, I eventually would get them getting older and stuff, and like toy guns. And then going to America, we found out from a family friend that you can go to a gun range and rent one. And at the time, I think we were on a work visa, and you're allowed to go shooting on a work visa. But the range we went to, I don't even think they cared or asked about it. But yeah, it was like on a 22 revolver is what I kind of, you know, was like got my start, you know, probably like 20 plus years ago, or maybe a little less, paying, you know, like 18 years ago. And Then we would go every few months, and then we'd start renting different things, like Glock handguns to like AR like 9mm carbines. And then when I turned 18, that's when I'm like, oh yes. And my parents still had that kind of stigma of like, you shouldn't own them. My dad had a couple, but it was still like, I remember him saying like, I wouldn't own one, but I went out when I was 18 and bought one anyways from like in a private sale from like some kind of shady guy.
No, that's at his house. That's a good way to like get into it.
Yeah, it was just someone I met on a local like gun forum and stuff, and he was a nice guy. It was just like that first experience of like just going into someone's house. I wouldn't recommend it unless
you went into his house,
or
was he like, come here through the back?
Yeah, I'm not proud of
my
like
wife.
Yeah, well, to be fair, I've buying and like trading guns for like, you know, since I turned 18, you know, just improving my collection and stuff, and you know, getting rid of old stuff that I just wouldn't work for me. You know, you meet a lot of people, and you know, that actually isn't too weird to, like, you know, I would recommend it to someone that you don't know, but like people on like forums that you've talked to for a couple years.
Yeah, like if you're like already internet friends.
Yeah. Then,
I would go inside Jordan's house for sure.
Yeah, Andrew and I met on the internet. We've since met in person, and he was not as weird as he could have been. But
not as weird as he thought I was going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't recommend like meeting someone off Craigslist or something like that.
I do that all the time. Do you guys remember Backpage?
No.
Vaguely remember Backpage.
It got taken down because it was like, you know, willfully facilitating prostitution. But basically anything that Craigslist was a little too spicy for Craigslist, Backpage was like, yeah, whatever.
I mean, that's what the internet's for, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I
sell whatever you want.
I bought Not and sold a number of guns a few times on Backpage while I lived in Arizona. And it was always like, I mean, I don't know, like meeting in like parking lots. People are like, yeah, I'll be there in 10, you know, like I'll be in this car. Let's do this fast. I think everybody was just sketched out like trading guns in public, but man, those were different times.
Yeah, I kind of got used to it. That would be the common thing. You just meet up at like a grocery store and like, you know, just go off to a little further in the parking lot and just trade right there. I've done that a bunch of times over the years. Just, you know, if I wanted one gun and got bored of another one, I just traded or something. And it kind of, I mean, in Florida, that's kind of normal. Like no one questions that.
Oh, yeah.
Typical Florida man stuff.
Yeah. It's like that in Arizona too, where it's just sort of like, you know, like, you see, you know, people would like drive by and see us and be like, oh yeah. Yeah, that happens here. You know?
Yeah. And then I remember having to transfer a bunch of guns from my family member who lived up in Maine and going to a gun store there to do it. And they were like, oh, you don't need to do this. Like, you just, I mean, we recommend you have a bill of sale, like for your own records, but you don't need a signature or anything like that. Like, you don't need a background check. And I was like, holy shit. This is awesome.
Yeah.
But I mean, then it got complicated when I had to register them in Connecticut. So that was, anyway.
Yeah. It was like that.
Everything's legal.
Oregon.
Everything was done legally. It was just a pain in the ass.
Yeah. But in Oregon, it's very much like that. So I grew up in Florida for I don't know how many years, but then I moved to Oregon in 2020. And then I had to get used to their rules. And one of those things was you couldn't do a private transfer, which kind of was a pain in the butt. But, you know, it's a different state. You got to get used to their rules there. And then now I'm back in Florida and back to, you know, going to a grocery store. I think I'm not going to call any. I've actually traded a gun at a fire station before. But in Oregon, it's very much like that. So I grew up in Florida for I don't know how many years, but then I moved to Oregon in 2020, and then I had to get used to their rules. And one of those things was you couldn't do a private transfer, which kind of was a pain in the butt. But, you know, it's a different state. You got to get used to their rules there. And then now I'm back in Florida and back to, you know, going to a grocery store. I think I'm not going to call any. I've actually traded a gun at a fire station before.
I mean, that's a good place to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, we had approval
it's
from
a public
the
place to do it.
Yeah, they gave us approval, so it's like okay,
that's good. Most firefighters are cool and not, you know, not like weird.
Yeah,
about guns.
Yeah, I've met a lot of cool ones, at least here in Florida. So. Nothing good, nothing but good things to say about him.
So would you, this kind of brings us into our other question. Do you think that rocket launchers should be held to the same standard and you should be able to buy and sell rocket launchers and things like that out of cars with people?
So right now, rocket launchers are a NFA item. So if
bullshit.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to describe
country.
Where we are.
Yeah.
Legally,
fair.
So right now they are NFA items under the category of destructive device. And what that is a firearm with a barrel over half an inch in diameter that doesn't have a quote-unquote sporting purpose. Like a 12-gauge shotgun can technically be a destructive device, but they've given that an exemption because it's a quote, it's a sporting, you know, weapon or a sporting, you know, device. There is a few shotguns that are now restricted under a DD, namely
like
the
Street Sweeper and things like that.
USAS 12, I think it is.
Yeah.
Is now prohibited as well, or at least, you know, restricted. Now, for me, if we're going off the most recent, you know, legal court case, which would be Bruin versus, I think, New York, or I can't remember the name of the court, but the recent one from New York, which held that for in order for a firearm to be restricted or regulated, there needs to be historical and traditional analog to support it. Now, rockets have technically been around. I mean, they've been around since, I think, the 1300s, but the modern rocket metallic, you know, you have a metallic tube with rocket fuel inside it. That's been around since at least the 1800s. So maybe not during the founding. Back then, they would have had a different type of rocket. But to me, there has been no... I've not found anything, and I've not talked... The historians that I've talked to haven't found any analogs that would support restrictions on firearms or launchers over half an inch. There's no supporting analog for that. So to me, it would at least be should be treated like a regular firearm, because there's no difference between a firearm under half an inch and over. I mean, it's just an arbitrary number, you know.
Yeah. So the argument could be made, I mean, if in court, if this ever wanted to go that way, that rockets and rocket launchers, like you said, they could just be treated like regular firearms.
And it is traditional. I mean, if you think of the American anthem, it even makes a reference to rockets in the anthem. Like, most people kind of don't think about that, but rockets have been a part of U.S. history as long as, or maybe not as long, but a very long time with like cannons and muskets. And rockets date all the way back there because it's a very simple and, I guess, cheap way of launching material, you know, a payload onto target. Now, the early ones weren't very accurate, but by, I think, 1844, a British gunsmith by the name of, I forgot his first name, but his last name was Hale. And Hale created the first metallic spin-stabilized rocket, what we would think of like a kind of like a gyrojet, if you're familiar with those, with the little angled nozzles on the back of the rocket. That idea comes all the way back from the 1800s. So they've been around a long time. Now, rifled artillery has always been more accurate, so that's why they went that direction. When they figured out rifling in barrels and you know, metallic cartridges, rockets kind of fell out of favor until World War II.
Guidance.
Is when they really came back with the, you know, the Panzerschreck, the bazooka.
Oh yeah.
And then they really haven't left since then.
I thought you were going to talk about like heat seeking and radar seeking missiles and shit. Yeah. But yeah, that makes more sense.
Yeah. Did they have heat? I don't even think they had heat-seeking stuff in World War II.
Man, I don't know.
I'm not the right guy. Like a history guy?
What do I look like? Some kind of nerd?
The funny thing is, they did have a pigeon-seeking rocket.
Yeah.
Or a prototype.
What?
Yes.
So they would train a pigeon or a type of bird to peck at a battleship or, you know, they would train it to do that. So when the rocket would fire, they would put this like live pigeon in the rocket or, you know, projectile, and it would peck at the rocket, and it would guide it based on the pecking of it.
I
would
kind
of turn
about
it.
This.
So
that's
technically
insane.
I mean,
and then it would bail out at the last minute, right?
Yeah, it would never get hurt.
Never.
a little dump or pigeon parachute.
I want to know what the pigeon was thinking the whole time it was being launched at Mach.
Gotta get that chip. Gotta get that fucking chip.
But like incessantly pecking still.
Fucking he's just waiting for the food to come out.
Yeah, and then but at like 9 G's or whatever the fuck that initial launch was just like, oh my God. Like, gotta keep pecking in that direction.
Well, okay, back then, those rockets were pretty slow back then because they were so heavy.
They also don't make pigeons like they used to.
They used to be real fucking brick shit house.
Back when men were men and pigeons were pigeons.
Yeah. But okay. So shoulder fired rockets came into style in World War II, you're talking about, right? Like as a way of like fighting tanks, right?
Yeah. With the M1 A1 bazooka was kind of like the first
fucking lit weapon. A weapon.
Yeah.
Fucks.
Yeah. And then the Panzerfaust came out, and that's not a technical rocket launcher. That is more of a recoilless launcher, which doesn't use a rocket motor, just uses a powder charge and a open rear tube to allow that pressure to come out. And that was probably, I would say, the most effective weapon for the time period, just based on how cheap it was to produce, and then how many... It's probably got the highest, I guess, kill rate out of all of them. And it was just mass produced. Unlike, you know, the Panzerschreck and the Bazooka, they had longer ranges, but they were a lot more technical. You had to put a lot more material into manufacturing those. Like the nozzles, the stabilizing fins were, you know, at the time stamped, I believe. And the fuel was harder to make than just regular black powder. So I don't think they were made in the same kind of numbers, but they were very effective at what they are. And I think from there, every country adopted some form of man-portable recoilless or rocket system for anti-armor. Because anti-armor changed the game more than anything. So this was that counter to that.
Okay, so the NFA was already on the books when rocket launchers were like became like a thing in the military, right?
The NFA was in the 20s, right?
The 30s. So rockets were before the NFA. But
I mean like those specific, like the bazooka wasn't like adopted by the military before the NFA, right?
Well,
so there wouldn't have been a lot of like civilian exposure to bazookas?
No, the rocket launchers and destructive devices only became law in the 60s.
Oh, shit.
So that was the last thing added to the NFA.
Those bastards.
You had silencers, you know, machine guns. I think maybe grenades. I don't think grenades had been put on there yet. But you know, the other one, short barrel shotgun.
Yeah.
It was the weapons that were used during the, you know, the crime wave of the early 30s with organized crime. You know, like Al Capone and, you know, all them.
Okay, so there's like a time period where civilians could conceivably have like mail ordered. Like a bazooka and like registered it, right?
Yes. And 20 millimeter, like any artillery piece without any, I think it would just be treated like any other firearm.
Do you know if that happened? Do you know if there were like people that were just like, you know, yeah, I want a bazooka for my farm?
So there is, well, a lot of the ones that are owned today were from that and they had to be amnesty registered when that law passed. So everything that's not newly manufactured came from that time, which is thousands,
nuts.
If not hundreds of thousands of them over the years.
That's nuts. Crazy. Yeah. I mean, that's awesome. Like,
so there's your tradition. There's your history and tradition.
Yeah. But there is, so what got them added to the list was there's two high profile crimes and unlike most of all American history using a destructive device. One was someone robbed a bank and they used a 20 millimeter, I think it's one of the Swiss 20 millimeter rifles to break open a bank's vault. And they used a suppressor on that too.
Holy
so
shit.
They had,
that's
it's like
good.
A, it's a seven,
respect.
Probably like 100-pound weapon with like a big drum, a big barrel of a suppressor on top of it. And they
presumably
used that
he had like buddies watching his back while he did it, right? Like, I can't imagine. Like, just everybody stay still.
Yeah, he needed buddies to carry it in with him.
Everybody relax. I'm just going to shoot at this vault like 100 times.
Yeah. And they were able to break the safe open. No one got hurt, but they left it there. And I believe because there were like only like 30 or 40 of them sold, they just looked at the background, like transfer, and they found the person.
Yeah. But nobody still were like, this is double illegal.
Yeah. They didn't, they just left it there. They just dumped the rifle. So there's a famous photo of that, you know, big thing, a big monstrosity of a weapon. And then there was a failed attack on the UN in New York. I don't know the specifics. I think it was related to the Cuba, and there was they wanted to attack the UN, so they were on the opposite side of the river, and they had a bazooka. I think the M20 super bazooka, and they tried to fire on the UN building, but it didn't make it across the river, and it just landed harmlessly in the river. But I guess the police found the rocket launcher and they heard the explosion of it, you know, going off in the river. And that was kind of like a high profile case. And I think after that, they're like, no one needs this. Because at the time.
That's exactly how I imagined Fed sound.
Yeah. Like, oh my God, they shot a rocket. Imagine being some fucking foreigner who's like never even seen a knife and somebody in America shoots a rocket at you. I'm like, how, like the existential terror of like, like they have those?
We are drastically underprepared.
Yeah. And I think the funny thing, that one may have came from like a National Guard armory. I know, I don't know for a fact, but I think that one likely came from an, you know, it was not rated, but you know. It left Telford. An armory. Yeah. It left an armory somewhere, and, you know, they tried to do an attack for, I think, a political statement. I think it was related to Cuban or anti-Cuban groups. I can't quite remember now. But yeah, that was the two high-profile cases that put, I guess, non-sporting firearms on the map, you know? And I think they just capped it at 50 caliber, because that was a common item owned with, like, M2 machine guns and... I mean, I wouldn't say really common, but, you know.
But how awesome is that that's still considered common?
That was the line. They're like, listen.
Common enough.
Let's be reasonable. M2 machine guns are as far as we can go.
Yeah, pretty much. And I think at that time, there wasn't a prohibition against making new machine guns. That came later on, I believe. And it was interesting. Is the gyrojet pistol that I talked about earlier, the 13 millimeter ones, are treated the same as a bazooka at the time, and the ATF actually raided the NRA museum, and they confiscated their gyrojet pistol.
What a bunch of nerds.
And then it was years
Couldn't
later...
Couldn't they just walk in, like pay admission, and go see
no,
it?
No, they wanted to slap
it.
Them around.
Well, I'm sure it was like...
They heard the NRA had dogs, and they wanted to go visit.
I don't know if it was like a violent raid or more of just like, you know,
fair.
An
non-violent
inspection.
Raid.
Kill the security guards and seize the building.
Yeah. But yeah, it was later changed into a curio and relic. So they know no one's making ammunition for it. And they know it's kind of like, you know, a little, you know, a bit of a dick move on
Obscure.
Their part. Yeah. No.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
So,
like, if you go commit a crime with a gyrojet pistol, like, you earned it. Like, you just have it. Whatever you got.
Have the crime.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
Judge is just like, yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
But, like, what a unique opportunity.
So, I got to know, man, how did you get started with this? Like, what are the steps that led to you saying, you know what, I'm going to build a rocket launcher, because the first one you built was the Panzerfaust, right?
Yeah, so it wasn't actually a rocket launcher, the first one I made. That would be the second one. But uh-huh. I always, you know, as I alluded to...
The first one we know about.
You idiot, were you listening?
No, I'm sorry, Yes, yes.
Panzerfaust is recoilless.
So,
sorry.
I think at the time, when I turned 18, I just got into guns, and I loved... the most obscure guns. I liked ones that weren't common. Like I didn't like, you know, the AR-15 at the time, just because I was kind of bored of it. Everyone had an AR-15. There was nothing interesting or new about it. So I just started collecting obscure and random guns. And then I was on ARFCOM of all places, and I saw someone that built an RPG-2, which is a more advanced recoilless gun. And I was kind of going back and forth, like, okay, if one person, you know, has done it safely, you know, that means, you know, first, it's probably legal. And second, you know, that'd be a fun thing to do. So, you know, I reached out to the guy, and at the time, he's unfortunately passed away now, but he was selling RPG-2 barrels, like blank, brand new barrels, because when they bring in RPGs or anything like that, they have to cut a caliber size hole in it and then weld up everything. So he was making brand new, you know, barrels for it, but you had to finish them, kind of like, you know, what we know now is like an 80% lower, kind of like that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you would have to weld on the parts, you would have to drill the primer hole, and then at that point, it's now a functioning weapon. So he hadn't got to the Panzerfaust yet, so I was like, I'll just buy a tube and I'll finish it myself. And that's how I kind of got started. I bought a bunch of reproduction parts, and then went to a local local gunsmith, got his advice on it. At first, he didn't believe me. I still remember his face trying to look at the Form 1. And he's like, this is not a real stamp. Because, like, a Form 1, you don't get, like, the little stamp, you know, for an NFA item. I don't know if you've got, like, a Form 4, but you get a literal, like, stamp, like you would at the post office. But with a Form 1, it's electronic, which a Form 1 is to make an NFA item. Form 4 is to buy it. So with a Form 1, I did it online. So they just print it out. They send you a PDF, and that's all you get. So he didn't believe me. So I'm like, I promise
Listen,
you.
Listen, kid, I know how a printer works.
Yeah, this is not, you know, this is, he just didn't believe me that I was legitimate. And I'm like, you can call the ATF right now, and I'll wait here. Like, I just didn't back down. But, you know, we got to talking, and he, I told him what I wanted to do, and, you know, he gave advice, and, you know, I ultimately was the one that manufactured it, turned it into the destructive device, but he helped make some of the parts. One of the things we were concerned about was the firing pin using better materials to handle the pressure of the black powder shoots out that primer hole. And that primer hole is what ignites the black powder in the tube. We were worried about, you know, that cracking or breaking. So we just updated the materials from the reproduction parts while keeping, like, the trigger the same, the sights the same. That didn't need to be changed, but the pressure-bearing parts had to be replaced. And he did a good job. And then I was the one that, you know, machined that final hole to make it into a destructive device. And, you know, I bought a bunch of reproduction warheads. So they look just like the original Panzerfaust, but they were just hollow. They didn't have any. I do not have a license for the good stuff, the spicy Fair. Warheads. Yeah,
the spicy candles.
Yeah, basically. But then I made some scrap homemade ones, which, looking back now, performed atrociously compared to you know, my later printed ones. But at the time, I'd never even like had a printer. I didn't really understand it. But, you know, we did successful testing, and then I was always a big fan of P.A. Ludi, and I wanted to make P.A. Ludi, if you don't know, he's a British gun activist who made, like, a homemade submachine gun in a shed and then got arrested, and I did a mini documentary on it. It's worth a watch, but basically he was just persecuted by the British government for this protest. And he made a book, and I kind of wanted to do a book in a similar fashion, but in my own way. So his was simply just a guide of how to make it. My books are typically the history, the explanation, the science behind it, and then what I did to build it. So it's kind of made it into my own, but it's kind of a similar spirit to that, the P.A. Ludi book.
That's awesome.
And it kind of went, that was very well received at the time. So then I was like, well, people like it and I like building stuff because I enjoyed the process. So then I picked another obscure weapon, which was the Fliegerfaust, which is the first anti-aircraft rocket launcher, like man portable one ever invented. So I was like, okay, well, I'm keeping with the theme of like World War II, might as well, you know, go for this. And that was my first rocket launcher, and that was a quite the experience, because black powder is pretty easy to use as in a weapon system, because mine were just cardboard tube. You have the projectile on one side, you have black powder that's sectioned into chambers, spaced, they're separated with a cardboard disc or a wafer with a flash hole, and that's it. And then when the primer is ignited from the top, the flames go into the powder charge, and it starts igniting each chamber. There's typically 4 to 6 chambers of powder, and that's how you're able to get a large powder charge. Like, what I was using was around 4 ounces. So about,
without immediately exploding the pressure
chamber. Yeah, exactly. You're just spacing out that propellant long enough to keep that peak pressure down. Long enough. But with a rocket motor, it's a whole different game. It's very difficult to learn rocketry. At the time, there wasn't as many videos as there are now from like big YouTube creators who kind of like go in depth in rockets. At the time, I found a mentor, and he would like literally FaceTime me as I was mixing fuel and
holy shit. This guy. So you literally were like, okay, are you sure? Are you sure that this is like, if the feed cuts, call 911.
Yeah. So yeah, it was kind of like that. So I bought a book that's like basically like
Rockets for Dummies.
Yeah, pretty much that. And it was a really good book. So I knew what I was doing before I started mixing fuel, but I needed a mentor there, and he lived in it like 4 states away at the time. And he would just make sure that I'm following the correct safety procedures and what I'm doing is looking correct. Like, so the fuel that I'm using, it's ammonium chloride, and it's mixed with like a little bit of aluminum. It uses a rubber binder to hold it all together. But before you mix the main like oxidizer and fuel, you need them to be wet, because if you mix ammonium chloride and aluminum together, they can explode. So that's why there's a set procedure of once the metal is wet in the binder material, then you can pour ammonium chloride and it's safe, because once it's in that wet binder, it's not going to spark or not going to explode. So
was
things
there a
like
part
that
of you that was doing this where you were like, I know these rules and I know that this is how it works, but I'm still really nervous?
After the first couple times that you kind of, I just throw the headphones on it. Yeah. And you just groove into music and
you just got tunes going. Like, if this is it, I'm going out listening to something I like.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you always want to be present. You don't want to like step away from it. But like, to mix the fuel, it's about 5 hours, 6 hours worth of work of just having a mixer. Well, the first time I did it completely by hand. So I had a little jar and I was mixing for like half a day, just mixing it myself. And then I eventually upgraded and got like a, a kitchen mixer.
Like a KitchenAid?
Yeah, KitchenAid. Yeah. I bought like one off Facebook Marketplace.
Dude, I hope you know like how amazing this sounds to somebody who has no experience. I went to rocket camp, like NASA camp as a kid, and I built a little rocket that went like 100 feet in the air. But I hope you know how amazing this sounds to probably the majority of people that you just learned how to do this and made rocket fuel, like presumably in your garage or your basement or somewhere away from the public eye. And like, that's the direction you're just going in. Like, this is amazing. I love this.
Well, all the information is out there. So it's not really anything new. It's just, I'm applying it to a new category than, the traditional. And most people would assume it's illegal. And I've done a lot of, in-depth looking at the law, and I try my best to stay 100% within the law. Doing this publicly, it's, you want to make sure you're doing it correctly.
Oh yeah. They'll fucking crucify. They'll make an example if they want 100%.
Yeah. And like, you always get the person that's like, free men don't ask permission. It's like, yeah, but if.
But like, okay, let's be realistic here.
Yeah,
I could build all this stuff. I could build all this, but then no one would ever get to see it, and then no one would ever get to know that what's possible. I share the same sentiment, like, sure, but
But you're doing it for educational purposes and for a specific purpose of like showing people.
Yeah, just educating what's possible. You know, it's entertainment too. People find this stuff interesting. So, you know, yeah, I could you know, be that, you know, rebel rouser and not do it illegally, but. And then if I do get caught, no one's going to even know. Or it's going to show up in the news, and then they're going to... The same person will be like, yeah, what a dumbass. Like,
yeah, exactly.
There's no winning, so...
This episode is brought to you by our friends over at Off Color Decals. The folks over there have a special place in our hearts, and not just because they paid us to say this, but because they've been printing our stickers since we started A Better Way 2A. Off Color Decals is a queer worker-owned co-op who's extremely active in the community. And they also just got married. Congrats, guys. Not only do they have a bunch of really cool stuff on their store, like their new Subdued Pride Flag Defend Equality patches, but they sell a bunch of other stuff like drink koozies, pins, stickers, and more. On top of this, they kick ass on the wholesale front. They've got state-of-the-art sticker printing capabilities with small minimum orders. If you've ever bought any of our stickers, you know how great they are. 5-year outdoor life, UV resistant, waterproof, the whole nine yards. They can do laser engraving too. It's pretty sweet. So this is for you. Whether you want to buy some cool stuff from them or use them to do some work for you, use code ABETTERWAY for 15% off your first order. And on top of that, if you're a nonprofit or a mutual aid group, you get an additional 20% off your wholesale order all the time. That's pretty nuts. So go to offcolordecals.com and check them out. Go, do it now, unless you're driving, in which case don't.
So we're talking about Second Amendment, rockets, legality, yada, yada, yada. I got a couple of questions kind of along parallel lines here. Firstly, is there a practical application for everyday gun owners to have a rocket launcher, knowing that they probably won't be like putting a high explosive charge in their rockets?
Yeah, knowing how they work, the understanding of how they work, and like the general, you know, it's like with firearms. I mean, let's say, you know, there's a big world war and, you know, it's like we're invaded and, you know, people are getting drafted or whatever reason. You're probably not even going to use your personal firearms. If you're going through the official channel, like let's say you're drafted, you're not going to take your own rifle, but you're going to at least from your own experience training for half your life, you're going to know how to use that rifle. Well, it's the same thing with like man portable weapons. I think it's reasonable to have a general understanding of how to use them in a recreational manner. And then if you ever needed it, and then let's say, you know, there's the other side of it. Let's say the government is bad for whatever reason. I mean, it's just like with firearms, you want to have it and not need it, and need it and not have it. I mean, realistically, of all the crimes, I could only think of two that have been committed, and neither of them anyone got hurt.
Yeah,
I mean,
These are not weapons.
Rockets
that lend themselves...
large caliber firearms.
Yeah,
they're not.
These are not weapons that lend themselves to crime, like robbery, things like that. Like,
no,
like
they're
the guy
hobbyists
that shot open
for
the
most
vault
part that are...
had a very specific use in mind, but they don't really, you know, beyond like possibly the FBI giving one to a teenager to do a mass shooting with, I can't see like a reason why anybody would do like a crime with one of these.
Yeah. And even then, I think the technology now has surpassed I think recoilless launchers and related rocket launchers can have their use in armed conflict, but their usefulness is now drastically less compared to a drone. So,
yeah, for sure. Oh my God. Like Ukraine has shown us tenfold what, like the capabilities of a store-bought drone and somebody with a modicum of experience with one.
Exactly. We've got to the point where I think there's applications for both of them in an armed conflict, but in terms of using it for just hurting indiscriminate people, like if a terrorist was to use it, I think they'd get more, they would go more to a drone or just a backpack bomb than having to create a rocket launcher, making it work perfectly, and then, you know, having it reliably, like, you know, explode on impact. That's not easy stuff to do. And for you know, it's terrorism. They're just going to put it in a backpack and they're just going to drop it off. Or, you know, whatever medium of getting it there that's easier to them. They're not going to waste their time.
For the most part, You'd have more luck building a trebuchet with a bucket of tannerite
than you would. That's probably more effective, to be honest.
And it's legal. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing saying you can't build a trebuchet, blow up tannerite in a group of people. But, like, there's nothing illegal in a lot of states about buying tannerite. There's nothing illegal about building a trebuchet. Like, those two things, just because it hasn't been done, this is the thing about laws, is, like, people, they're very reactive. And once somebody does it, people are like, we got to ban that. But you can do something like that, and assuming your geometry is on point, probably.
Which mine always is.
Yeah, I don't even think I got to geometry in high school, man. But yeah, it's wild to me that, like, those are the things that that lawmakers focus on.
Yeah.
Well, but, you know, we see in Ukraine, like, drones are, you know, they are the solution, right? And I think it would be the same anywhere that you have access to drones for fighting, like, you know, lighter armored vehicles, even up to, like, tanks. But you still see, like, that one of those Freedom of Russia Legion, whatever, the guys that crossed the border in northern Ukraine, there's a GoPro video of him just whipping out a law and shooting it at the treads of, a fucking T-84 or something.
I think I saw that very up close, and like things like that. I don't think it actually went off because of how close he was to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, every Russian's like, what the fuck is minimum arming distance? Like, they just don't understand.
Yeah. And we have.
What do you mean they don't understand? Like Russians are a bunch of Neanderthals.
They don't get it.
Rocket, go boom.
Yeah.
I think we saw that.
Russians are not like that. I'm not being.
And I am saying that they are.
Whatever.
Yeah, we saw that
Russian invaders. Yes,
the British NLAW in the beginning of the war, someone shot that down out of a window at some Russian tank variant, and it didn't go off because of that minimum arming distance.
Yeah, which like good thing for him, it didn't go off. You know,
oh, it was right on top of the tank. Yeah, that was gonna.
Yeah, you would have gotten. Yeah, you might.
How did he shoot that
in
inside of a? Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I answered my own question. Or by answering my own question, I mean I didn't need to ask it.
Yeah. And just for the audience, you know, a lot of new modern weapons have been designed to be able to be fired indoors. With the older designs, typically you'd have a lot of backblast. And when you fire that in an enclosed space, it can, like, blow. It can, like, explode your lungs. It can do a lot of damage.
Which is a no-no.
Yeah, you ideally don't want to do that, but
or at least
thing,
only do it once.
Yeah, once and done.
Make sure you really need to do it.
And I think the another part to the being familiar with the white weapons themselves, like recoilless launchers, in a recreational sense, and then if you ever needed to use it later, we've noticed in Ukraine and Russia, soldiers putting these recoilless launchers and putting the tube on their shoulder. Not on top, but on in the shoulder.
No,
and then
no.
Blowing their arm and, you know, shoulder off.
Oh, I highly recommend that you do not do this.
And it's been recorded several times now. Like a lot of times, they're just throwing conscripts or less than adequately trained people, and then they don't know. And this happened in World War II as well with the Panzerfaust. They would give these out to groups without, and not everyone would get training. And then they would put the Panzerfaust tube on their chest, like over
Jesus
their heart.
Jesus Christ.
And they'd fire, and then obviously it blows, you know.
Can you imagine being on the opposite end of that and seeing somebody do that and just being so fucking confused?
Just imagine the hate that's coming with that fucking rocket. Like,
no, can you just imagine seeing an enemy
that guy
soldier
did was shoot at you?
But, like, seeing an enemy soldier, presumably who you think is knowledgeable about his weapon system, launch a rocket and just get fucking murked.
Yeah.
It even featured in a film. I don't know the movie, but it was like, I think it was Finnish troops ambushing Russian troops, I think. And one of the soldiers did that. And I was like, that's like one of the first media depictions of it. But it actually did happen because not everyone was trained on it. And it was such a new weapon system. And they had to put so many, in my recent book of the Panzerfaust, so I redid the original book, I included the manual, which like emphasized the point of making sure that the rear tube is clear. And they even made a little jingle. I forgot what it is now. But it's like a little rhyming jingle to make sure troops knew at the time not to put that on in their shoulder, to put it over or under their arm. You know, the traditional, like, holding it at the hip, or, you know. I got a lot of flack for it, but the original book had the tube on my shoulder. But that was actually a legitimate trained way of firing it, too, because not every option, like if you're firing it in a trench, you can't fire it underhanded. You have to fire over the shoulder, because
I'm going to trust you. If you're showing me a picture of you firing it shoulder fired, I'm going to trust the guy who went through the trouble of learning rocketry and then FaceTiming an expert as he's measuring ingredients.
You know, actually.
I think the least of our concerns is how you actually shoot the thing.
I got that a few times, and then now I have a safe folder, I think, of like 20, 30 photos of examples
you can
from
send to haters.
Yeah. It's
that's
like
awesome.
Mass spam. Like, here's all the photographic evidence. It was done this way by almost every faction that either had or delivered them or captured them. Americans did it
Sucking
that way.
Nerds.
French did it that way. Germans did it that way. The Volkssturm would have, or the militias at the end of the war, they used them too. I mean, it was just under, over the shoulder. They didn't care as long as you fired it and didn't blow yourself up.
So I got to ask you, man, where are you actually doing the testing for these? Do you have a range that's been super accommodating and cool, or are you going into the woods where it's legal, presumably, or like, how do you go about doing that?
So for the virtual Panzerfaust, we did that at Ares Training Facility in Florida. They were super nice. We were, they let us do it on their, like a secondary range that allows for people to do training and stuff. And I just, you know, at the end of one class, I knew the owner, and he was like, hey, can I test these when you're done with your class? I'll help out during the class. And then I tested there and it worked out. And then I came back for like a dedicated, like, hey, I'm going to shoot these for, you know, to get data from them. And that was great. And then when I moved to Oregon, for the Fliegerfaust, you just go to a rock quarry. And the great thing about living in the mountains is the rock quarry is like 100 feet tall. So it's very difficult to get anything to go over the berm, especially with
That's
rockets.
That's awesome.
So we did a lot of the early testing there. And then with the M202, which is a much larger rocket.
The Flash.
The Flash from the movie Commando, if you've seen that in the 80s.
Yeah.
We were very very lucky to have someone who owned basically a ranch let us fire it on there. And those would go between 1,500 yards and 2,000 yards. So we,
That's
yeah.
insane.
How much energy do they have at the end of the flight?
I mean, they'll burst open on impact, but they're not going to be, you know, I mean, you know, you don't want to get hit by it, but you're not going for speed with those. You're delivering a payload. In our case, it was char. And in theory, and this is what China does, and I think Vietnam, is they fill those type of rockets up with fire extinguisher powder, and they launch those into forest fires and building fires.
Well, the original idea was thermobaric rockets. You'd ripple fire 4 thermobaric rockets and just, like, you know.
Yeah, you pepper it. And it was used heavily in Vietnam. It was originally known as the XM-202, and that's where they were trial testing it, and that's when, I guess, they you know, it was it wasn't like napalm. It was a spicier version of napalm, and it was used for destroying weapon caches.
Yeah, well, it's a fuel-air warhead, so it's like... Yeah. It'll
Once
burst,
it bursts open,
oh,
mix,
I see.
Mix fuel and air, and then a secondary charge ignites it and creates a really powerful overpressure.
Oh, well, you're talking about thermobaric in general. Okay. I got you.
Yeah. The original M202 wasn't thermobaric. It was a little different.
Oh, it was not. Okay,
it
my
was
bad.
Purely incendiary, but it was oxygen sensitive.
Listen to me mansplaining to the rocket man.
Well, I only know because I had...
Jonathan, it was a thermobaric...
Actually,
yeah, and I don't mean to do that, but
please, that's
no,
what you're
please
for.
Tell Andrew you can
you can
coming from me, I'm giving you permission to tell Andrew to shut the fuck up.
Shut up, stupid.
But it makes sense. And that the thermobaric would replace the incendiary, because eventually in the 80s, you know, some people may say got a little PC, but cooking your enemies got a little frowned upon. So if you just incinerate their organs, it's a little better with thermobaric bombs.
Oh, but... God.
It's a little
that's
more
the humane version.
So fast.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So with the firefighting, they would do the similar thing, but when it impacted, it would actually spray, you know, inert materials that would put out the fire. So in theory, my M202 can be used for signaling, you know, munitions in theory, but it's obviously a destructive cool. device, but it has, you know, genuine, you know, non-menacing, you know,
application.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to work tomorrow and say, listen, guys, we need to get rocket launchers for firefighting. Yeah. Like there's firefighting proven firefighting applications for this. Can you imagine being the person whose house is on fire and the dude jumps out of the
Step
fire
aside.
Truck with a fucking rocket
Not
launcher?
Not one dude. All one, the entire all every of, firefighter who responds
everyone
has
their
own
fire, like, their own rocket launcher, and they're just like,
Besides, get citizen, get
I'm here
ground.
To rescue you.
And the thing with the
shoot the fire
with the Chinese
the most
ones,
American thing ever.
Well, the Chinese started doing it, and their launchers would have like 50 barrels, and they'd literally
That's
just
so cool.
It would just be like one after another, like you're just spraying that area with. And
they
like,
got a long history of multiple launch rocket systems.
Mm-hmm, yeah, so they just reapplied that to it.
Yeah,
and then they have drone ones too, I guess, for like high rise buildings that can like shoot into the building. But I'd hate to be the guy like trying to hang out the window, trying to breathe. You put your stick your head out for a breath, and then there's a rocket hurtling toward.
Bro, have you ever gotten dry chem, the fire extinguisher material, on your face or in your lungs or anything like that?
No, I heard it's not great.
It's
That's why
the
we...
worst thing, the worst feeling ever.
Would you rather do that or get fire on your face?
You could die from both.
Oh,
I'd rather not burn to
death. My bad. I didn't know.
Yeah, you see these videos of people getting sprayed in the face with it. Like you could die a very uncomfortable death, like drowning in your bodily fluids.
We were debating to put fire extinguisher powder in there, but then we didn't know what the environmental impact could be. You know.
Yeah,
you don't have to
deal with the ATF, not the EPA.
Yeah, they're kicking in my door. I thought chalk is a lot more safer, but it was a placeholder for that.
Yeah.
And it was private land, so we just, you know, I didn't want to, you know, not that I wanted to destroy public land, but I wanted to pick a material that would just dissipate. Chalk
pick
is very...
somebody's land that somebody's paying taxes on, at least. Not for.
Well, okay, yeah. So we're talking about warhead limitations. One of your more recent projects, you call it the hypervelocity rocket launcher?
Yes, that is...
This is... I don't know if your launcher is based on an existing design, but the theory of the hypervelocity rockets was really cool. And, you know, it's like, unfortunately, you know, there are other much more practical ways to get hunks of metal moving really fast. But the hypervelocity rockets were a really cool idea. And so, like, theoretically, this could be like a rocket weapon with no payload, right?
Yeah, the idea behind it came from the 1980s at the Redstone Arsenal. They developed a kinetic energy rocket for light vehicles and aircraft, or anti-light vehicle and anti-aircraft. And at that time, anti-tank, but by the time it was developed, tank armor had thickened up a lot more. So they moved up to the low sat and other very large rockets. But the rocket I'm copying is the... Spike, and it's the single penetrator kinetic energy rocket, and it moved. It was a 1-pound tungsten rod with obviously the rocket motor behind it, and it traveled at 5,000 feet per second, and I think it could penetrate about several inches of steel, homogeneous steel.
Yeah, and guys, when you see videos of the testing of these kinds of rockets, you would not realize that these were just hunks of metal. When they hit the targets that they're shooting at, the pyrophoric effect is just like insane.
Yeah, especially with the tungsten. Or if you use depleted uranium, they really spark up. Obviously, you can't really. I think you can own depleted uranium. Too spicy. But yeah, you're not going to be able to acquire that realistically. But you can get tungsten fairly easily, and that project is, it's a 2-inch rocket, so it's, you know, it's not a big rocket to make. It's the more modern rockets that are able to take out tanks. You're looking at like a 100-pound rocket. Now these are more like a 3-4-pound rocket. They could take out like a BMP, you know, light armored vehicle. They're also, they developed the single penetrator one, and then they made multi penetrator versions. So at motor burnout, it would open up basically between 18 and 200 little metal darts. So it's like a shotgun in the air. And depending on what size of dart that you use, you could, you know, have quite a few or just a few larger ones. And that was aimed to take out Russian combat helicopters, like, you know, the Russian equivalent of like the Apache. And they planned to use that on a Humvee. It had 54 tubes, so 54 of these kinetic energy rockets. And then it had 6 Stinger missiles. So it was a whole close air defense weapon system that they planned to use this on. And it was just fascinating. It didn't get, at the time, with the way cost effective, it was just cheaper to use a Stinger rather than lots of missiles that were unguided. But now we're kind of going back. Now that you're not shooting down a $30 million aircraft, you're shooting a $500 aircraft, I think we're going to see more going back into that unguided volley fire, you know, very fast moving rockets.
Okay, so this isn't just something that you're bringing to the civilian world. You think that this could have like legs, like as an actual like battlefield implement?
Yeah, I am working with a couple folks kind of in talks about making, you know, the concept of using a miniaturized version, maybe in like 20 millimeter, that could be used in a similar fashion against drones. That's been something we've kind of talked about. There's a lot of like legal side of it, because shooting down an aircraft, which a drone is considered, you need a waiver for. Typically, they frown upon shooting down aircraft.
No way. So. Really? You can't just shoot down your drones?
Yeah. Apparently, that's frowned upon. So, you know, just navigating that, but it's something that, you know, I've made several books and I've kind of enjoyed the process, but I think there's room there to actually make a product eventually, you know, with all the correct licenses, to make a product that can have real world use for defending people, defending, you know, important, you know, a big thing is like, you know, drones could be used to take out power grids. And, you know, you could have like a sentry that has these rockets, because a lot of these power stations are remotely operated and they're not going to put Stinger missiles or anything near, but you can put these rockets that are, they don't have explosive payload. They have limited applications outside of that. So they can't really be as abused as much as like a Stinger missile could, taking down like, you know, an airliner or something. So I think we're going to see these, like, you know, automated remote weapon systems that can be used, these hypervelocity miniature versions of them, rockets, to take down drones more cost effectively. And you're reducing the risk of unexploded ordnance, because you don't want to fire a rocket. It goes duds. Someone's camping nearby and they step on it 10 years later and they blow a leg off. Or,
yeah,
I mean, that's the idea, is reducing the amount of explosive, and the payload to go that fast can be considered explosive, but if it's already been fired, it's been removed, and if it doesn't fire, it's gonna degrade over time considerably.
Speaking of unexploded ordnance, that's something that they're having a huge problem with in a lot of these older war zones, especially in the like Eastern Europe and whatnot, where they have areas that are uncleared minefields that people still can't go to, or people do go to and they end up dying because they step on unexploded ordnance.
Even today in Ukraine, forget about historical battlefields.
Yeah.
It's gotten really bad.
But is, well, but look, is that something that could be used for that application also on like a wider scale of like clearing out areas, properties of possible unexploded ordnance like that?
Talking about using the multiple projectile thing to
It could definitely be used more because if you look at tank shells, a lot of them that aren't like high explosive, they're just, you know, the same concept, using a high density metal to at a high speed to penetrate. And like these tank shells, if they don't explode, or if they hit something, they'll explode if they go, you know, the reaction of hitting a very armored target. But like once they've been fired, they're not hazardous anymore, other than if you're using depleted uranium. Sure, there might be that's a debated topic, but you know, tungsten, you've just got a rusty piece of metal in the ground. Sure, it might have some environmental impacts, but it's not like a like 5 pounds of explosive just waiting to go off, and you know, God knows how many years, because explosive does hold itself for a long period of time. I mean, people still find Panzerfaust warheads, and I think there was I think it was in Denmark. They put it up to a tank. They found it in this ground, and then they set it up on a tank, and they used a jerry-rigged igniter, and they blew it up, and it still penetrated the tank after 80 years.
Wow.
The shape charge still held its own after, you know, in the dirt, rusting, you know, as long as it doesn't, I guess, seep out over the years, as long as it's kept contained in there, it's still very much dangerous. I mean, I know, I think when it comes to Ukraine, if the war ended tomorrow, I don't think they would make that country safe for another 100 years. To me, it just seems like there's so much undetonated ordnance there that I don't think they'd ever, it's going to take generations to pick it all up. And it's still, the war is not done. The war is...
Yeah, it wouldn't make sense to do it now.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm just saying, like, there's going to be a whole lot more ordnance dropped there, however long the war lasts. So, it's a moving to kinetic energy weapons would be the most humane way to go for war. And I know it's weird to say that, but the problem with
but it makes sense.
Kinetic energy weapons is that with the rockets, they have a long minimum effective range. So, you know, with a bullet, it's effective pretty much as it leaves the barrel. Or like a tank gun, it's pretty effective right at the muzzle. With a rocket, it needs time to build up speed. Because the burn rate on these rocket motors is fairly slow compared to the gunpowder. That was what my other project that I'm working on, kind of in conjunction with the hypervelocity, is using smokeless powder as rocket fuel. So it has slightly slower burn rate than like a traditional gun, but at the same time it's faster than composite propellant. So sure, that's the idea.
Yeah, it can generate a lot of pressure with powder.
Yeah, so that's what we're kind of working on, a design that uses just a little bit of smokeless powder through a nozzle. It's based on a patent from the 90s, and we actually have the rockets printed. We're just waiting for a good location to test them at, high-speed cameras, collect a bunch of data, but that's kind of going on in conjunction with the hypervelocity project.
Yeah.
I mean, these could be useful for civilians too. I mean,
it would be a safe. The problem with making composite propellant is it's very easy to make a mistake. Not that you would blow up while you're making it, not that type of mistake, but like, If your rocket fuel isn't consistent, you could blow up the rocket motor when you're firing it. That's why
it's a very, very public, famous now case from very recently of a propellant mishap exploding on a YouTuber.
Yes, ballistic high speed. But though that was actually still black powder. That was just like my Panzerfaust. The problem is, with that one, it appeared to be overloaded, as well as the tube had it was a D-mill that was reactivated,
right,
with
so it
questionable
had a sleeve on it. Yeah,
questionable quality.
I think what they came to too was that it was possible that the so you're talking about those like segments of fuel in there that like perhaps they had become dislodged or like compacted in there so that they didn't ignite in the sequence that they were supposed to.
Yeah, it could have burst open. So with the RPG-7, which blew up, there's a large expansion chamber. So it's possible when they put it in there, it could have snapped or bent or got crooked. And with an RPG 2, it's just a smooth wall tube that's the same all the way. So it's very safe in the fact that there's nowhere for that powder to go other than out and pushing on it going forward. With an expansion chamber, you're adding a new variable. You have this whole open space with lots of room for propellant to break, room for propellant to get clogged, you know, a buildup of buildup of gunk from the black powder.
Yeah. Something that could potentially give you like a secondary ignition.
Exactly. And it was pretty, he's very fortunate to be alive, and it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
The way it was demilled, a lot of the times the hole is pointed to the face of the fire. So if that if he fired one with the with that hole that was re-welded, it would have blown his face off. But fortunately, his was pointing down. So his kind of body armor, I think his arms took a little bit of the blast, but that chunk, that large chunk of steel didn't hit him. Which it saved his life. I have no doubt that he wouldn't have survived that one. But
using smokeless powder, though, you think if you can find a way to do that in a rocket, you think that could make things a bit safer for civilians who are doing this?
Yes, if it's done, like, I would recommend home making those rocket, but if it was made just like any other firearm, it would be the same. Like, you're dealing with a very consistent burning powder. And if if the science works out, like, you know, you keep a consistent burn rate, you're in a well within a safety margin. I think, you know, it's a lot safer than using composite rocket fuel.
Okay, cool.
Because composite rocket fuel, if you have air bubbles and like while it's burning, so it's a circle that burns outward toward the case of the motor. If you have a big air bubble in that, you're going to see a huge spike in pressure. And a lot of these rocket motors can't handle more than half their... and they're designed to only take double the pressure that it's expected to take. And with these air bubbles, you can go way beyond that. So with smokeless powder, normally with double base powder, the bazooka used double base powder. But it was like solidified and it was used in like tubes. What I'm doing is instead of solidifying it, using it as raw powder and using a rocket design that as the rocket moves, it doesn't blast out that powder and it burns slower, but it keeps that powder inside the rocket so you get the benefit of restricting that flow of gas to create thrust, you know, essentially how a rocket motor works. So we've got the rockets ready. We're going to hopefully test maybe in a week or two.
That's very cool.
Maybe they'll blow up. Maybe they won't, but it's worth a shot just to.
Well, because even all other aspects that we've talked about aside, just the availability of the materials, I think, is going to be better. Especially considering that a lot of your stuff has to do with like 3D printing and like homemade weapon.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm looking at ways to do it in printed plastic. But right now, the rockets are. We had a company very generous who printed a couple prototypes in Inconel steel, which is a very good steel for high temperature applications. And maybe we might be able to reuse these rockets a couple times just to get more data. That's kind of the goal with like 3D printing is it makes it accessible, especially when there's metal 3D printing that's on the consumer level. These rockets will be more available to the average person. Like any other firearm. So we've done ones in 0.49 cal, so they wouldn't be NFA items. So in theory,
that's cool.
If they worked really well, they could be another option as like a regular firearm, just a recoilless firearm.
That's neat. I love getting around laws.
No, seriously. Well, because, okay, so you're talking about, so offensively, drones have become very, like, very much the obvious choice. But
you mean
to defend against
ostensibly?
No, I mean like offensively, like using them.
I'm so sorry. I'm an asshole.
No, ostensibly.
I said the word wrong.
So for like attacking, right? You would want a drone because why wouldn't you? That just makes sense. But if you're sitting next to something you want to protect, so you've got nets, you've got shotguns. Those don't work great. You've got, if you're real rich, you got the RF jammers. But if you've got access to 3D printing, you could have a, you know, a multi-projectile hypervelocity rocket launcher that you built, that's powered by smokeless powder, that's like available off the shelf. And you could, as a civilian in a sticky situation, in an invasion, in a civil war, whatever, you could have a real valuable, you know, possibly very effective tool to protect yourself against drone bombs.
Yeah. Especially with like communities and stuff. Let's say you just, you know, and not end of the world, but you know, if, let's say you're a Ukrainian town or something and you don't have access to all the tools. In theory, like if this was a 3D metal 3D printing, or if you can make a plastic version with, you know, some kind of way to add metal to be like the penetrator, you could make it yourself and be able to defend yourself without, outside of traditional, you know, channels. And it's just a all around good tool. From like the storage of it would be a lot simpler. It would be like storing regular bullets. You wouldn't have high explosive storage that, you know, can blow up very easily if it's struck by something. Now, ammunition, that would happen too, but to a lesser extent than high explosive. And then you've solved the problem of unexploded ordnance. So what good is a town if you can't walk around without stepping on a, you know, a dud and then getting your leg blown off? So there's that aspect.
Good.
Not I wouldn't recommend that
safe
town.
Yeah, 1 out of 5 stars on my Yelp review.
Unless you're one of those guys that just town. Hates their legs.
Yeah.
Fuck these legs.
God,
oh, like
I hate
that guy
walking.
From what was that Asian guy who did that recently for insurance fraud? He froze his legs
what?
In dry ice to
no.
try to claim. Yeah, he tried to claim the insurance money, and they
he
were
did.
Like, "Nope." So he lost both of his legs and didn't get the insurance money.
Oh, bummer! How'd they find him out?
I don't know.
His plan was foolproof.
Worst trade yeah. deal ever.
I think they started like investigating it, as they do. You know,
they probably looked into involved. It for 5 minutes and were like, "Oh, you froze your
yeah,
legs."
They're like, "Guys, this guy's clearly
why
idiot.
He posted about it on Twitter."
Yeah. Jonathan, that we're getting towards the end of the episode right now, and I wanted to ask you before we go, how do you think, because I know you're big into 3D printing, I am not, I have one, but I'm like a monkey humping a football with it. Like I'm constantly sending images of bird's nests to Andrew in our group chat, like, what did I do, what happened? And but for the layman, how do you think 3D printing has changed the landscape of things like building your own firearms launchers, which are not firearms, or unless you're form running it. But how do you think that 3D printing in general has kind of changed the landscape of home built things that are really cool and go boom?
I would think on a technological avenue, it's opened up the door for more possibilities and creativity. But I think in a more important aspect, it's changed the philosophy of a lot of people. So before, if you wanted to make something, you had to have a larger skill set of being able to weld, be able to fabricate, be able to machine. Now, I mean, you still have to do a little bit of that, but now the mindset has changed that with this printer, I can solve a lot of the initial problems really early, and then you know, get the firearm or launcher that I want to build. I think it just it changed the perspective of people realizing that they can do it themselves, whereas before they would just assume that it was too much work and effort to be able to do it. And I think that's the biggest change, is that the mindset. Now with 3D printing, there is limitations with all materials, and I think we're going to see in the next 10 years that there's going to be a lot better plastic filaments. They're going to be able to be made a lot cheaper, a lot quicker. Printing speed is going up faster. So like my M202 build, that took a month to print. All the components, that was a solid month of printing. I'd say within 5 minutes, that could probably be done in maybe maybe a week. Less than that, maybe. So it's just, I see that changing over time. We're just going to get a lot better materials a lot faster. I'm not sure we're ever going to get home metal printing, maybe one day. Maybe that'll be figured out. But right now, it's just very expensive to do to get that in a consumer level. Right now, I think the minimum's like you got to pay like 10 grand for a minimum. And even then, the quality is not going to be as good as, you know, if you're just buying a mill or a lathe and you make these parts the traditional way.
Yeah, that it's definitely one of those things that I feel like it's kind of like when the first iPhone came out, or I like even go farther back and say cell phone. People were like, this is not going to ever have a consumer application. Like this is, I remember with beepers, even going back even further, people would tell my dad, like my grandmother would tell my dad, the only people who have beepers are drug dealers and doctors. And, like with cell phones now, you know, we have a computer on our phone. In the span of time that, you know, most of us have lived through, like aside from our parents or grandparents that are still trying to figure out cell phones. But like I was in middle school when they came out with the first smartphone, I think. And I see 3D printers now kind of like in the incipient phases of like where they're going to go. And we're kind of, all we can do is speculate as to how advanced they're going to be in a short period of time. But, you know, I definitely see metal printers coming with the commercial applications available. I think it's only a matter of time before there's a consumer level equivalent, like within the next 10 years or something like that. And then we're going to get really cool things. I mean, if you say one day I can print car parts or motorcycle parts, we're done.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
And then I think it'll shift people's perspective of like more self-reliance in the sense that you to make parts yourself is going to be a lot more readily available rather than, you know, I think lathe and machining, it's not easy and it takes a special kind of person to learn that. Whereas printing, it's more plug and play. And it's not just that simple, but it can be that simple if you put in a little more effort compared to lathing and machining. That's a tremendous, I mean, you don't have to go to school for that, but it almost requires going to school to know how to do that very well and do it safely too. You don't want to end up like a live leak video.
Yeah.
Get famous as the exploding guy.
Yeah. The guy that gets wrapped around a spinning machine.
Yeah.
I hate that. I've seen so many of those videos. Also, before we let you go, man, we have a tradition on this podcast where we ask you your deepest, darkest fears, and you have to share them with us right now. Now, if you had a piece of advice for people listening, it could be related to what you do or it could be something completely unrelated, but what would that piece of advice be?
I guess trust but verify. I noticed this recently with the community. People have come out with products and ideas that kind of skirt that line of legal and not illegal. I would recommend people to, you know, when someone says something's legal, I mean, you can trust them, but just make sure that they've done their legal due diligence. And people, a lot of it comes down to interpretation of the law. So, you know, there's a lot of gray areas in the firearms community in terms of like what's legal and what's not. And it often changes. So like 10 years ago, not many people questioned the brace, you know, braces were, you know, they were legal. I mean, it was kind of accepted and it took 10 years for the ATF to finally, or not finally, but they did do something about it. egregiously, and hopefully, you know, we can get SVRs off the NFA. But you know, when you get into rockets or you get into destructive devices, make sure that you're doing your due diligence and also you're doing safety checks. So I remote test now after seeing what happened to Ballistic High Speed and the guys that were there. I would recommend that you don't read my book and then just assume you know everything about it and then go do it yourself. Just, I'm not an expert. You know, I wouldn't trust everything I say. I could have made a mistake somewhere in it, or it may have worked for me, but it may not work for you. So, you know, trust but verify would be my advice.
That's a good one.
Trust you.
Trust you and I'm going for it. Yeah, that's a good one, man. Well, thank you so much for coming on, man. This is awesome. This is very informative.
Another instant and classic.
It's definitely, I think it's going to be one of those episodes that people are going to listen to the second time and still pick up things. It's like one of those, it's like an M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Yeah, and I try to respond to everyone. So if you have more in depth questions, just send them my way, and I'll try to get back to you on like specific questions. I try to, you know, get to as many people as I can, like answering their questions reasonably. Yeah. So,
and if you have questions, you should still follow them on Twitter and wherever. Instagram also.
Instagram also. Yeah, we'll have your link in the bio of this episode.
So cool seeing fucking.
It is. It's really cool seeing what you're working on, man.
I appreciate it. And hopefully I have more footage soon. So it kind of like comes in waves. Usually takes a few months for me to get new testing videos just because it's an expensive kind of hobby to fund. But, you know, I should have.
You tell your wife that we're all grateful for her putting up with you and your shenanigans because you're doing good things for the community.
How does your wife explain this to friends? That's what I want to know. I want to know how that conversation goes, because most people are like, oh, yeah, he's in the guns. And like, okay, there's not really many questions associated with that.
My husband builds rockets on the internet.
I don't think she really tells her friends, but like explain it to family.
That's probably a safer bet.
Yeah. Usually with like family, like bringing it up for the first time, it's interesting. But to be fair, I haven't, like everyone just kind of assumes I know what I'm doing, which I kind of do, I kind of don't. But, you know,
you're at that, like that peak of like, where it's like, okay, so, you know, enough to, God, how do I explain this?
You know, enough to know what you don't know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. So it's like, you know, at the beginning you could be like, you know, oh yeah, I know plenty, but then you're experienced enough to be like, well, there's a lot here to learn.
Yeah. It's kind of like that. And I feel like people just find it cool, 'cause it's just different. And there's no malicious intent. It's like, you know, I'm not spouting, you know, like, you know, an ideology and then just like, oh, hey, this is this cool thing I do. And then like, you know, usually it just starts off like a regular conversation, like, oh, this is a hobby of mine. And, you know, it's not done in a context of like, you know, I have my own political opinions, but I don't like. That's not my icebreaker.
You're not like
into
getting on the internet and being like, here's the rocket to assassinate the president.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's not brought up in that context. So it's not.
This is not a joke. This is not a joke. I'm going to blow up the White House with this rocket.
And then your door gets kicked in.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like looking out my window right now, just waiting.
Oh, hey, you're Gun Guy 69. I met on the internet. No, it's FBI joke. Arming extremists. Anyway, thank you so much for coming on, man. Thank you for having me. Absolutely, I'm glad we finally got to get together.
Absolutely, yeah. I know it's been a little while. We've been kind of trying to fit it in our schedules, but we finally made it happen. So,
the way she goes, boys.
Heck yeah. Well, and enjoy your family. Congrats on your two kids on the way.
Yep. So three.
You got twins
total.
Coming. You got twins?
Yeah, dude.
Oh, yeah. Fuck.
Twin boys, and I already have a 2-year-old boy, so.
Yeah, I've got two sons, and I was like,
girl. And, you know, luckily, prayers were answered. We're getting a girl.
Well, congrats. Well done.
Yeah.
Congrats to everybody. Everybody have a healthy rest of your weekend and, you know, life.
I kind of forgot we were recording.
As my mom would say. Yeah, we're still recording. As my mom would say. My mom's not Jewish. My grandma's Jewish. Anyway.
My mom's not Jewish either.
Goodbye.